We'll hear Kim Pate, the director of the Elizabeth Fry Societies, speak about minimum security prisons for federally sentenced women and corrections inadequacies in setting up alternative models of minimum security prisons, which already exist outside of Canada. Kim Pate also speaks about economic and political factors that are affecting more and more people in Canada, and how this ties in with the prison system and the need for communities to resist these policies.
Yeah, I mean, another part of the Human Rights Review is the fact that creating choices, the report of the Task Force on Federally Sentenced Women that was issued in 1990 recommended, you know, cottage-style minimum security settings for women. It was based on a real model, the Shakopee prison in Minnesota, which to this day still has no fence around it. To this day has all levels of security of women, including a mental health unit, including a segregation unit. And now the prison has been in that community for more than 130 years, and the community is literally built up around the prison. So there's still no fence, it still operates. And so what it says to us is, if in the United States, not the beacon of progressive anything, this kind of model could exist, the fact that Canada wasn't able to implement it is more a testament to the inadequacies of corrections than it is to, and perhaps the inadequacies of the community, but more the inadequacies of the administration and the manner in which they were set up. So that we now have, in 2003, some 13 years after the task force recommendations, 13 minimum security beds. In fact, I've been corrected that it's now down to 10 minimum security beds at the Isabel McNeil Minimum Security House in Kingston. And those are the only minimum security beds, real minimum security beds in the country. Now, if you ask corrections, they'll tell you, oh no, you know, Case or Kim is, you know, not aware of the, or is not telling you about the minimum security beds in the new regional prisons. But those minimum security beds are minimum security beds behind razor wire, behind in with camera monitoring, and basically they're in the same compound, in the same institution, with the same static security perimeter, and for that matter, the same static security in the institution on the in the, you know, in terms of the wiring and alarming of the houses and doors and that sort of thing, as all of the other women's units. So the reality is we really don't have any minimum security beds left, and the Isabel McNeil House is slated for closure. So ultimately we'll end up with a situation where we could have no minimum security beds for women, real minimum security. So in a context where we know virtually everybody in corrections, and certainly those in the community, and especially women themselves who have the experience of being in prison and are there now, will tell you is that the biggest challenge is the acceptance of communities for women to actually be able to integrate back into their homes, however they configure that, whether it's community of interest or family or friends, that sort of thing. And so the reality is that we're in a situation where fewer and fewer resources are available at the same time as the recommendations were the complete opposite. So we're ending up with 5 new mini prisons for women across the country. And that's one of the biggest challenges to our entire, to all of us, I think. I mean, our network, the women themselves. And another component of our human rights review is to demand that, as part of that decarceration strategy and as part of our challenge to the whole classification scheme, to demand that any kind of assessment tools that are used assess the risk that the community poses to women. And in recognition that that's the risk that really needs to be managed. So if a woman comes in, instead of using the current risk assessment tools that says if you've been unemployed, undereducated, homeless, on and on, those are all risk factors you pose to the community, recognizing that it's increasingly the community that poses the risk to you, and saying, okay, what, imagine what it would look like if we said we took an inclusive approach or a risk-based analysis that is about what do we need to develop in the community to in order to accommodate. And this, you know, this is not new. This comes from a lot of the work that's been done on the charter, on the duty to accommodate the needs of individuals who have those protections. And so we're saying that if someone comes, the greater the constellation of quote-unquote needs, the greater resources should be available to that woman, and that she should be the broker of that. She should be the one determining and directing where those resources get spent. If she needs housing, then she has some direction there. If there's a determination there are mental health issues or treatment issues, she determines whether that's drug, alcohol, you know, past sexual abuse, whether it's, you know, whatever it is, that she determines and directs that. And so it would be the complete opposite of what currently happens, which is those who are identified as being the most needy often have the fewest resources in the community and are housed in the most secure environments. And so, of course, the reality is they get worse and worse. I mean, if you've got someone with a mental health condition who then is maxed because they're there, and that means they're kept in segregated conditions, then they're kept in more and more isolated circumstances.
I got a question, because the things that you're mentioning now have been risen in conversation among us. And basically and ultimately it comes down to the basic unwillingness, because the answers are so obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody looking at these kind of situations, like you said, there's been one that's been working in Minnesota for 130 years. There are other examples around the world where we can adopt or at least try. We know what's wrong. Mm-hmm. We know what not to do. And our question is, what could the interest be to maintain a system that maintains such wrong, just keeps on wrong?
Is it economical, you think?
Well, I think it's, I think it's, you know, economic interests, it's political interests, it's power base, you know, to actually relinquish the authority to the most oppressed to address their oppression. You know, it's not a novel idea, mm-hmm. but it's certainly a revolutionary one, and one that doesn't resonate with those who have the resources, the power, and the authority. They don't want to. I mean, to actually have those over whom you have the power and control adopt that or develop some of that power and control means you have to relinquish some of yours, and it's not a popular...
It seems to me, though, that more and more people in the community are affected in some way or another with the mm-hmm. issues that are affecting prisoners, with the cuts in the social welfare and all that kind of stuff is affecting more and more people, and it seems to me that it's a good time for the community to not depend on those who say that are going to provide us with the services and the things we need, and to get together in community-based,
mm-hmm.
more community-based resources,
mm-hmm.
you know, because we see it with the men prisoners too, with parole and stuff. The less you have, the less chance you have of getting outside, because of the less you have. And the less you have means that you're going to have the less outside.
Yep.
It's just a vicious circle, like you said.
It is. I mean, you know, I think in some ways when we talk in theory, it sounds really easy to do it. I mean, the practical reality is to be anti-oppression, you can't be pro-capitalist. You can't be pro, you know. And so it's so many people who will spout theory are often more... You know, and this shouldn't be seen as, you know, as insulting to anybody who considers themselves liberal in terms of their thinking. But, I mean, that is a more liberal notion that allows everybody to do everything they want,
mm-hmm.
you know. And the reality is that we're not, you know, we would be talking about taking resources from that group that has, you know, a fair degree of and more than their fair share of resources. And they're the ones who actively resist it, and they do have the power and the authority and the control to limit it. Now, that doesn't mean you can't do some of what you're talking about on the ground level, and I think there is some of that. And I agree, I think there's a rising up of, you know, the history has been a rising up of the oppressed. I worry that there's a complacency right now that people think it can get taken care of by government policy or changes in policy. I mean, the fact that we haven't seen a rising up of people in this province when the cuts to welfare happen, the fact that we haven't seen a rising up in BC. I mean, I was out there a couple of months ago going through the province, meeting with our membership and meeting with other groups who were doing work and individuals and groups basically we were meeting with to talk about what are you planning for April 1st, 2004. And some people just looked at me and had no clue what I was talking about. In April 1st, 2004, thousands and thousands of people will be cut off welfare in British Columbia, because April 1st, 2002, the provincial government brought in a policy saying that from then forward, people would only be eligible for 2 out of every 5 years for welfare. So what that means is the 2 years is going to be up next year, and all these people are going to be cut off So as I'm going around the province, you know, people are going, holy shit, you know, that's what that means, you know, and starting to realize, even there were welfare workers in one of the sessions, and they said, oh no, I'm sure that's not what it means. I think we'll have some discretion. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, check, because, you know, if I'm wrong, I'm happy to be corrected, and I'll correct, you know, and I'll call everybody back who I've dealt with already and proclaim that I misinformed everybody. They came back that afternoon and just said, no, you're right. We'll have no discretion.
So they're
discretion.
Cutting them off completely after
cutting
2 years.
Cutting them off after, completely after 2 years for three. But where are they going to end up in those 3 years? Well, the street, dead, or in jail, yeah. You know, just like we've seen in Ontario. And so now there are some exceptions, and we're trying to build, you know, there's things like if you have so many barriers to employment and life, you know, life, then you can build up. There's some for people with disabilities. You know, there's some exceptions, but it's going to be major. So then I started getting calls from women, and there were two in particular that, you know, just, you know, cut to the bone when you think of it. But this one woman in particular said, I've got to get my kids into child welfare now before April 1st, 2004, because when I'm cut off and I end up on the street, and she knew, which I didn't know until she told me, that those, the other cuts that are coming, which are really important to know about too, is that there will also be a 40% cut in child welfare. So they're going to squeeze both, and, you know, there's going to be all masses of people falling through into the street, into the jails, you know. And so she was saying, you know, she wanted to try and get a decent child welfare placement for her kids, decent child welfare placements for her kids, so that they would be slightly better off come April 1st, 2004, than it looked like they were going to be. Now, you know, never in my wildest dreams would I have ever, or nightmares, would I have ever thought I'd be talking to someone about how to get their kids into care so they could be fed and clothed and go to school and have a future, you know, in the sense that this is a mother who ever, has never had any child welfare involvement. There's no concern about her ability to parent, but there will be as soon as she's poor and not able to feed her kids and, you know. So, you know, she has no idea how she's going to manage. And so we've been trying to, you know, and the other reality is women don't want to, not just women, but men, but particularly women with their children, don't want to be then going doing media campaigns. And I think people would be horrified to know that story. Mm-hmm. But it would be so exploitive of her and her kids, too, to be, you know, asking them to bleed publicly, literally, for, and yet that's the kind of stuff we're seeing. And so I think it's true there's groups of people rising up, but the public psyche hasn't quite got to that place like they did in the 30s after the Depression, you know, and we had the Winnipeg General Strike. And, you know, I think we need to have some of those sorts of uprisings again.
Also
for
propaganda.
To...
There's more, much more propaganda these days.
There is, that's right.
In terms of fear of crime and who's committing it. And
yeah, that's
that
right.
Plays a
yeah,
big
no,
role
that's true.
To keep people divided.
Well, yeah, we'll just look at the Squeegee Kids, the Safe Streets Act here. I mean, do you remember the first media around Squeegee Kids? It was all, look at least they're trying to make a living and they're on the street, you know, and it was all positive. And then suddenly it's like, there's a few too many trying to, you know, get
demonized.
My money, and so now they've been, yeah, vilified and demonized. That's right. So I think the challenge is there. I mean, we've actually changed our mission statement. Just it was just changed at our annual general meeting in June of 2003. We've been talking about it as though it's changed for a couple of years. And what we changed it from is we used to talk about working with and on behalf of women and girls in conflict with the law, which presumed not just an agency, but a volition, that people somehow chose that to be in conflict with the law. And it's, I think, you know, in recognition of the political, economic, and social realities, we talk about now that we work with criminalized mm-hmm. women and girls, because it's increasingly the laws and policies that are in conflict with people's lives, not people actively choosing. So some other things we're working on with the Law Commission has done some work on what is a crime and how do you define crime. We're talking to law schools and groups of lawyers, and I've been doing some work on training judges and lawyers and that sort of thing around challenging mens rea, challenging the whole notion of what does it take to have a guilty mind. This whole idea that you have to plan and premeditate it. If your choice is the street, death, or jail, how can you say you've really made an active choice? So using, you know, old social contract theory to inform the law, and so encouraging lawyers to do more of those sorts of challenges. So we're hoping we'll see some of that happen soon. I think if you start to focus on all how bad everything is, it can feel like there's no hope. And So one of the things that is really important, I mean, for me, I often talk about vibrating between absolute rage and absolute despair and trying to get action somewhere in between the two. And so sometimes, some days it's, and weeks and years, it's literally, you know, pulling one woman out at a time. And, you know, we just had a successful 15-year review, so you attach to that for at least the moment and say, well, that woman now will be out instead of spending another 10 years, or probably it'll take a year or two to get her out, but instead of spending another 8 or 9 years in jail, she'll be out. But the other thing that I was really, just recently had the opportunity through some training I was doing with around clinic lawyers to meet up with some folks who were over here from South Africa. And our constitution internationally looks great. I mean, we're held up as the, you know, the best of lots of things in the world. Now the reality often belies the, you know, the theory and the law. But when I met with one woman in particular who's doing challenges in South Africa where they have an even better constitution, but she talks about after the end of apartheid, what happened was that they actually saw apartheid ended, and then many of the people who had been the revolutionaries who fought against apartheid ended up being part of the government. And so there was a complacency that started to build, and the challenges weren't as frequent. But a group that she's with has started now suing ministers and having government officials charged with contempt of court and contempt of their breach of their responsibility where they have failed to follow through on the Constitution and the laws as they're intended. And they've done it by just doggedly following cases, documenting them and going through. And so we're in communication now, and it's an area that we often talk about. I mean, when Kim Rogers died, the woman who was on house arrest for welfare fraud 2 years ago now, 2 years ago, August, actually, August 9th, 2001, she died. Many of us talked about when Kim Rogers died that Harris and the other political henchmen who were the architects of the so-called common sense revolution in Ontario, the cuts to social welfare, the cuts to health resources, all the rest of it, cuts to education, that they should have been charged with criminal negligence causing death. And it was in the context of some of these sorts of actions that we started talking to the folks from South Africa and have started to talk about how we could actually document some of these pieces and start, maybe not criminal negligence causing death, but certainly at the very least start to raise contempt proceedings and breach of their duties of office, that sort of thing. Now, whether or not that would achieve change would remain to be seen, but it certainly holds up some hope for, you know, those who are supposed to be accountable for their actions, who rarely are held accountable, being held accountable. And I think we're starting to see some of that sentiment when you start to see folks for white-collar crime. I mean, Martha Stewart, and despite all the jokes about, you know, what her cell will look like if she goes to jail. The reality is we are seeing an interest in holding accountable some of those who are doing the same behavior and getting away with it. And there's a young woman who's inside who's doing a little project for us. So I can hardly wait till she gets it done. And we've contracted with her, and she's actually doing up a list going through the Criminal Code of Canada and taking all the offenses and listing when it can, you know, in what context it's considered legal, in what context and by whom it's considered illegal. And I think that we'll post it on our website as well when that's complete. And I think that will be a really telling list. And we all know it happens. I mean, and that's why the work the Law Commission is doing too, I think, is important, because they're actually talking about what is a crime and this whole notion that crime is a theory. It's not a thing. It's not a tangible behavior. The same behavior, every behavior that's considered criminal, you can find a context where done by certain people in certain situations, it won't be considered criminal. And in other situations,
it will
be.
Too.
Yeah, it changes. That's right. So I think, you know, those things, I think, do hold out some hope. I think people increasingly are seeing someone they know being impacted by these social policies, and that will cause, I think, some rising up, I hope. So
that's the hope.
Yeah.
You have been listening to an interview with Kim Pate, the director of the Elizabeth Fry Societies. This interview was recorded in Ottawa in early July 2003.